Yes, if you have your phones with you, our Bibles, we can look at this verse together, these verses together from James 2, verse 14. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such a faith save them? Suppose a brother or a sister is without clothes and daily food, and if one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? And in the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accomplished by action, is dead. But someone will say to you, you have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by my deeds. You believe that there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. You foolish person, do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? Was not our father Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness, and he was called God's friend. You see that a person is considered righteous by what they do, and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? As the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. It's a very powerful passage that we'll come back to very shortly. This week I was at Westminster Abbey for Nowruz. What is Nowruz? It's the Coptic Orthodox New Year. Why is it celebrated now? Well, that's a good question. But essentially, this service led by Archbishop Angelos, who's the chair of the International Council of Sat7, celebrated the Coptic Orthodox Church's founding by St. Mark in Alexandria. But really, the calendar begins in 284 AD, and that was the start of the Roman Emperor Diocletian's reign, during which hundreds of thousands of Egyptian or Coptic Christians were killed for their faith, martyred. Probably, how many have heard about this even? No. But obviously it left a huge impact on the church, the survivors, because that's when they date their Coptic calendar from. And if you followed the news in the last decade, you will have heard or seen many more stories of martyrdom in Egypt. In 2013, after the overthrow of President Morsi, who was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, there was a sort of insurgency, of chaos for a month during August, where the Muslim Brotherhood went around burning and destroying Christian institutes like the Bible Society bookshops or churches or Christian-owned businesses, killing a number of Christians in very brutal ways. And the reaction to that was quite amazing. Instead of what the Muslim Brotherhood hoped for, creating a civil disturbance, a civil war even, between Muslims and Christians, and there are 8 to 10 million Christians in Egypt, and I use this word politically in one sense, because you were either born a Christian or you're born a Muslim. But in any case, many of these Christians just came out and openly said, we forgive you, and turned the other cheek. They went to their burnt-out church, where written on a blackened wall was, we hate you, and they wrote over it, and we love you. This was so amazing. This was followed by more church bombings in the last 2 or 3 years, and I remember one Egyptian television interviewer, a Muslim man, he was interviewing a lady whose husband had just been killed. He was a guard at one of the churches in Alexandria, and he died stopping a suicide bomber coming into the church. And the woman was explaining how she forgave those that murdered her husband. And he looks at the camera and says, what are these people made of? The impact of Christian love and forgiveness as a testimony and a witness in Egypt has been remarkable. And then, of course, you would have heard of the 21 Muslim Coptic Christians who were beheaded on the beach in Libya just a couple of years ago. A terrible experience for them. But the mother of two of them called our live program that week to say that she forgave ISIS for doing it and thanked ISIS for videotaping the testimony of her two sons where they refused to recant and become Muslims and committed themselves to Jesus and put themselves in Jesus' hands. Amazing. Again, the forgiveness and the love that was shown in the face of atrocities that disturbed the whole of Egypt at that time. If the book of Hebrews had been written today, surely these Coptic Christians, Egyptian Christians, would have been mentioned in chapter 11 among the heroes of the faith. And yet we, as Baptists, are sometimes a bit suspicious of non-Baptists, and especially of Orthodox and Catholics. I was converted through a boys' Bible class down in Minehead many years ago. And then eventually baptized in a church in London that's still my supporting home church, I'm pleased to say. But I was taught that I was a Baptist because I was saved through grace alone and not of good works, lest anyone should boast. And the more traditional churches, well, they teach us to work out our salvation in fear and trembling by faith and good works. Today's reading from James 2 comes after James has already been teaching some very practical Christianity, care for the widows and the orphans, the need to avoid favoritism, the impossibility of keeping the law, stressing that if you break one law, then you're breaking all of them. And then in this passage that we just read together, James goes on to argue that a faith that does not result in deeds or action is not a real faith, not a faith that will save us. And this faith, in verse 19, is more than just believing in one God. Even the demons believe this, and also it's part of the Islamic creed that is called out from the minaret five times a day. We believe in one God. No, actions are a sign of or a validation of real faith. So James, citing Abraham in verse 21, offering up his son as a sacrifice, even though it made no logical or theological sense to him, he was, by faith, obedient. And Rahab the harlot, who's again listed in Hebrews 11 as a hero of the faith. I've learned over the years, many years, that it's dangerous to generalize about any church or denomination. I've met some amazing people in the Coptic and the Catholic churches in the Middle East. I've met some terrible Baptists. I've been to a Baptist church where, if that had been my only experience of a Baptist church, I would never have gone to another Baptist church in my life. And so generalizations are dangerous. And there's real life in the churches of the Middle East. It's not easy to be a Christian, as we heard just very briefly. So people don't take their faith lightly. I was in Baghdad the week ISIS invaded Mosul, and I went to an Armenian Catholic church. I'm not quite sure why, but I ended up there as an invitation of the bishop. And he showed me this church. It was beautifully decorated, completely empty. And he says to me, "Isn't this wonderful? All my congregation have gone to Europe. I have all this space now for Muslims to come into my church." Or I went to a Catholic church in Baghdad where 2 years earlier, 43 people had died. Insurgents, Muslim fundamentalists, had taken over the church and held the whole Sunday congregation hostage, even the children. And they'd given them the chance to convert to Islam. They refused, even the children. And then the government forces stormed the church. Hand grenades went off. 43 people died. 63 more were wounded. The government had paid to rebuild the whole church and decorate it, but it was devastated. And all the churches today, because of that incident, have got guards and blast balls and razor wire around them. Christians are struggling in the Middle East. So what maybe divides us about faith or works leads us to really conclude that generalizations are dangerous, and perhaps what divides us more is semantics. A faith without works is dead. So works are important. They do show that we have a living faith. Of course, this subject is a big one and controversial one, and all of us have different opinions on this. But the one thing I want to stress is that we have real brothers and sisters in Christ across the Middle East in the different churches, and we need to pray for and support them in these very difficult days. And this, actually, supporting the church, is one of the two main goals of SAT 7, to support and encourage the church in its life, work, and witness for Christ. We'll look at a few slides. This is the area where we work, from Mauritania over in the left to Afghanistan in the right. Huge area, relatively small number of Christians, only 3.5% on average, but you might be surprised to know that 3.5% represents about 18 to 20 million Christians. Now, half of them live in Egypt, but there's large numbers of Christians in Lebanon, where they're the only about 30% of the population. Also in Iraq, Jordan, there are Christians. Certainly in Syria, there's a large Christian community. So it's not a hopeless case, and it's certainly one we need to pray for, especially when you think that 10% of the Middle East was Christian 100 years earlier. Now, this simple chart shows you the complexity. I say it's actually simplified because it says up here, those of you who can't read it, it says Syrian rebels. Well, there's actually 1,000 different Syrian rebel groups. But seriously, it is an area in an unprecedented crisis. There are 60 million people across this region that are directly impacted by the ongoing conflicts in Yemen, obviously Syria, Iraq a little bit, Libya. I don't know if you've followed that, but it's really a totally failed state. And certainly it's a very difficult place. But in this, and we've seen it in Iran, because for 40 years now, there's been Islamic rule in Iran. All we hear is bad news. I mean, just even the last few weeks, it's been all about, you know, security in the Gulf and America threatening and holding British ships and all this. The truth is that the majority of people in Iran are very tired of the mullahs. And because they have rejected the abuse they've had from the mullahs, imprisonments, silencing of free speech, economic monopoly by the mullahs, lack of employment opportunities. Actually, Iran has the biggest drug problem in the world today, partly because it's next to Afghanistan and there's a free flow of poppies into the country. And the government hasn't cared about the drug problem because, you know, somebody on drugs is less of a threat than somebody demonstrating in the street. So today, I can say with total confidence, Iran is the most open country in the world, certainly in the Muslim world, to the gospel today, and the most responsive, and where we're seeing the church growing at its fastest. Somehow that doesn't get into mainstream news. But it's just totally amazing the responses we get to our Iranian broadcasts that go out from Cyprus and parts of Canada, from California, and live from London 4 or 5 times a week, where we have a studio in West London. So it's really thrilling what God is doing in these days. I could take a lot of time to go into the details, but I won't. If you invite me back for another, you know, 3-day lecture, I can do that. In this area, there are 3 main language groups. Now, of course, there's many dialects and variations in the language, but these are what we call broadcast languages. Arabic, of course, is the biggest, with 360 million people spread over 23 countries. And then we have Farsi, which is Persian, or various versions of Persian, like Farsi or Dari, that is spoken mostly in Iran, of course, but certainly in countries around Iran. And then Turkish, which is spoken by another 100 million people. So it's about 500 160 million people speak one of these three languages across the region. So this is our mission field. These are the places where we focus. And interestingly, more than 400 million people out of those 560 today have got satellite television at home, because it's really the only way to get uncensored news and information. The internet's there, of course, but it's heavily censored. It's not available in many places. It's actually, you require literacy to navigate the internet, and so on. So satellite television has become the most trusted and the most available source of uncensored information. So you see these amazing rooftops just cluttered with dishes. Even in Iran, where it's still illegal to have a satellite dish, at least 60% of the population have got satellite television. And the biggest importer is one of the mullahs in the government. So we have four channels. One is in Arabic, one is in Persian, one is in Turkish, and we have an Arabic children's program channel. Now, why do we need a separate channel for kids? Well, first of all, they're important, but secondly, we're covering six time zones. So by the time, you know, children are coming coming home from school in Morocco, when we could show programs, the children in Bahrain have already gone to bed. So having a 24-hour channel for kids has been amazing. And it's become actually one of the most trusted channels for Muslims, including Saudi Muslims. They tell us this. This is the only channel I can trust my child with, because they see the change in the child's behavior. He's got a peace with him. He's more respectful to his siblings. He's not jumping all over the furniture, hitting people over the head with rolls of newspaper like he would if it was the Cartoon Network. And they're accepting of the Christian teaching along with this. And they know they won't be suddenly exposed to radical ideas or scenes of violence or body parts laying across the street. And it's a place, a safe place for the children. So we broadcast the kids' channels in Arabic and the Arabic channel on the Egyptian-regulated Nilesat satellite, and covering all those countries very precisely. And then we also broadcast to the Persian service to the whole of Europe. But more recently on this smaller satellite footprint, a more sort of high-powered beam from satellite, which means that you only need a dish about this big to pick up the signal, which in a country where it's illegal to have a dish is a great asset. And then we broadcast on the Turkish-regulated Turksat satellite. Now, we've got a 10-year government license to broadcast as the only Christian channel on this Turkish government-regulated satellite system. I don't think we could get that license today. We got it 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and it was a miracle then. But things have gotten so much worse. But we're still there, and we're still impacting Turks who've heard very little about the Christian faith. In fact, the church in Turkey is the smallest in the region. Less than 0.2% of the total population are Christian, even in name. And there's only about 7,000 or 8,000 believers from a Muslim background. And Patrick Johnson describes it still in Operation World as the most unreached country in the world. So this opportunity to be on the Turkish satellite is just God-given. I mentioned satellite television's importance as the only uncensored medium. We've been able to do some viewer studies, commissioning them to Ipsos, a marketing company, but imagine you're a Saudi national living in Saudi Arabia, and you get a phone call from a Muslim in a marketing company in Jeddah, and he says, "Are you watching Sat 7? Sat 7? No. Even if you are, would you admit it? And then the next question, "Do your children watch Sat 7 Kids?" "Oh no, I'd never let my children watch Christian television." I mean, these numbers are what came out of the survey, including several million people in Saudi Arabia admitted to watching Christian television. So we know the numbers are very understated, or at least they're not exaggerated. And it's very exciting to see the level of interest in the Christian faith reflect that. Now, Christian television, I'm from a publishing background. I have to confess, I hate television in general. It's a very superficial medium. You have to have a face for television. You have to wear makeup and sit in front of an artificial set. And then you're going to use this to communicate truth. It's so phony. And then we take the implicit and make it explicit. Nobody knows what Jesus looked like. Oh, but we're going to show them what Jesus looks like. So it's a very dangerous medium. And it took me 2 years of struggling, coming from a print ministry background, to go into television. But if you're going to reach women in closed homes in countries, if you're going to reach kids, if you're going to reach the illiterate, if you're going to bypass censorship, it's the only way. So we've embraced television, recognizing its intrinsic weaknesses and strengths. But it's a bit more than that. Christian television is also a problem for me. This idea of you support the channel by selling your airtime to televangelists in different parts of the world, mostly America, that doesn't also go down very well in the Middle East, where most people hate Americans. And you make Christianity then look like an American import with culturally irrelevant content. No. So we had to redesign television. And 80% of our programs today are made by Middle East Christians living in the Middle East mostly. Of course, Iran is more difficult because we tried it, but it didn't really work out very well. We lost a lot of equipment, not ours, but the contractor. So we mostly broadcast from outside. But it's important that we give a voice to local Christians to speak into their own culture. So we do dub and subtitle some things. Good movies, Christian movies, good documentaries, cartoons for kids, that kind of thing. So every day we have teaching and devotional programs, youth programs, women's programs. We have a lot of call-in programs. We have church services, of course. We have Christian teaching, songs, worship, some systematic theological content, but in a more entertainment-based television format. We have a lot of animation for kids. We have a lot of films. We have a lot of original dramas, but drama is, while it is the best medium for television, it's expensive to make it. So again, we've had to cut back on drama production recently. And we also have some social impact programs, as we call them, addressing disability, unemployment, microenterprise development, health, hygiene, safety, the treatment of women, and so on. And more recently, we've had this educational series for children. There's over 16 million Arabic-speaking children who are not in school today, who could be, mostly because of conflict zones, but also because of poverty in countries like Egypt. And so we've been having a systematic school series, it's called My School, where we teach from a Christian worldview, but without overt, heavy Christian content, maths, science, English, Arabic, French, and other subjects, kindergarten through level five. We're working on level five. Wonderful feedback for the programs. Your programs are the reason I became a believer in Christ, wrote this woman from Lebanon. From Iran a few months ago, you sent me verses from the Bible through social media, and I forwarded them to five of my friends. 2 weeks ago, they gave their hearts to Jesus. Please send me more verses so that we can grow in our faith. This is Amira from Egypt. You teach me how to get to know Jesus, how I can behave like Jesus, how I can be generous, loving others, and respect adults. You explain that in simple ways. I can't wait for your shows. Or this lady from Iran, thank you for your live shows. We cannot go to church in Iran, so it's really beneficial for us to hear from Bible teachers and church pastors that we can call and talk to. Last year we had 329,000 cases. And our case is when somebody contacts us and we respond to them and they respond back and so on. That's a case. That's about 900 a day, which is 40% up on the previous year. So you can see this amazing interest in the Christian faith. We have 2.2 million followers on Facebook. I won't go into all the other statistics, but this is the growth of viewing on YouTube. 37 million last year views on the channels. I'm going to speed up a little bit because I'm aware that we need to finish, but we have offices in these locations, or studios, I should say. So we have a beautiful studio in Lebanon that was built for us by a donor. We have a 25-year lease for $1, which I have paid myself. And so we're able to use this amazing space there. In Cairo, of course, Cairo is very important. Most number of Christians in the Middle East live in Cairo. And most of your teaching programs are coming from Egypt. And also this production center for the Persian service I mentioned in West London. And a small Persian production center in Cyprus. And in Istanbul, amazingly, we do have these people. The man in the middle sitting down with the gray hair, he's a well-known comedian on Turkish television. He became a believer and has an amazing testimony. You walk down the street with him in Istanbul and everybody wants to have a selfie with him. And then our international office staff, where we also manage a lot of the Arabic work and the Persian work. And this is our international council, a really mixed bag of people. There are some Baptists there, but there are also the Armenian Orthodox Archbishop of Tehran from Iran. He comes to our meetings. The lady in the middle with the check coat, she's Rita, the new CEO. Take a look at her face. She used to present, and she still does sometimes, children's programming. And her face is well known across the region for that. But to dismiss her as a children's presenter would be a big, you know, to think she's just a children's presenter would be a big mistake. Our long-term mission priorities, I mentioned one of them was to support the church, but basically we want to make the gospel available to everyone in the Middle East and North Africa, especially those who are not otherwise reachable, children whose importance is often underestimated in mission strategy. There's 150 million kids under the age of 16 in the region, and to women who remain generally isolated from other forms of Christian witness, and to the illiterate whose only source of uncensored information is satellite television, and those, of course, in closed countries, in closed homes, people who perhaps have never even met a Christian and will never meet a Christian. And then, as I mentioned, to support and encourage the church, very important, especially in these days of turmoil and chaos. Our annual budget is $13 million, which is less than a quarter of Channel 4's budget, and we run four channels on that, and we have 25 million viewers. I think Channel 4 is a disgrace, and they should share their funds with us to be more effective, but... So our annual cost to provide a daily service for a known viewer for a whole year is about 50p. I think that's not only cost effective, but it's also the only way that many will hear about the Christian faith. So let me finish by saying it's a very misunderstood region. We think of it as hopeless, as a basket case. Christians are leaving, there's no hope for the church in the future. It's so wrong. Yes, Christians are leaving. Yes, it is difficult. But there are many coming to Christ in these days. And if when we started with 2 hours a week of broadcasting 23 years ago, if that was important, I believe it's 100 times more important today. Because, first of all, we have 100 times more viewers. But secondly, because people are 100 times more open today than they were when we began. So these are really exciting days. I would encourage you to follow what's happening. We have a very valuable update on the Middle East, as well as prayer news that's available from the UK office. And if you'd like to get some of the literature, it's on the back table. But do also fill out one of these papers you'll find and give it to Jolly Julia. She calls herself Julia Jolly, but she's actually Jolly Julia in my way. Just let me come back to this theme of faith that we've been talking about this morning. Sat7 is very much a faith ministry. It began, as I say, 23 years ago, despite many naysayers. They said, oh, Christians won't want to show their faith on television. It's not like radio where you can hide your face. Or the government's going to block you. Or how are you going to find the funds? And what equipment do you have and experience? Nothing. It was 2 years we were broadcasting before we got our first camera. We were renting time in a secular studio. But God really did give us the faith and the vision to do this. And I'm amazed when I look at things today, how it's grown, the way God has raised up people, mostly trained on the job. But God has taken their talents and multiplied them tenfold. And then each year's budget that we set, and we're this next 10 days, we're working on finalizing the budget for 2020. There's $1 million missing that's less than last year in projections from support offices, mostly from the US. I don't know quite why, but there is a crisis in a way. But we're going to take a step of faith, and we're going to have a budget for next year. I'm sure I'm not responsible for it, but I'm still on the council. I will approve it. But God has provided in miraculous ways. I remember a couple of years ago, we couldn't pay salaries in Cyprus. And in Cyprus, everything shuts down in the summer. I mean, you can kind of die on the street, nobody will notice you. And then we get a check in the middle of August from the VAT department. It was a VAT refund for a year and a half VAT, it's only 80,000 euros. How? These people are all sleeping or gone home or on holiday. It was a miracle. Last year we had another crisis. We couldn't pay salaries. And then a UK businessman who'd supported us in a modest way over the years sold a business again in August and sent us £250,000. I couldn't believe it. Lack of faith. But God has done these amazing acts to sustain Sat7 in its ministry. And it's been like a great encouragement to the staff. They feel God's with us through these difficult times. So I will stop now. Thank you so much for your prayers, for your support, for your interest, and for this opportunity to share a little bit of all the things God is doing in these days. Thank you.